Let me first thank the organizers, Dima and Frank in particular, for doing all the groundwork and for inviting me. So I'll talk about a project I did during my postdoc at Harvard with Misha in particular. And this is basically about a new platform for neutral atom experiments. Let's see if this works. Okay. So I'll start out a bit more general by kind of the spirit of the workshop, talking about experimental goals and challenges in terms of synthetic quantum matter. I'll then review two experimental approaches for neutral atoms that are from top down and bottom up. I'll give you a brief introduction how we do it now at Harvard. This is basically a bottom-up approach that includes some measurement and feedback procedure. Show you some experimental results, talk a bit about current and future work, and then come back to this initial question, what do we actually gain in terms of the goals and challenges we have experimentally? Okay. Let me start out very broad by just like listing a few systems for studying synthetic quantum matter, if you want to call it like this. So there's traditional solid-state materials, there's now solid-state qubits in terms of superconducting qubits and V-senders, Majorana wires, and so on. There are more traditional atomic systems, ion traps in particular, and neutral atoms. Neutral atoms in various incarnations, and optical lattices, Rydberg atoms, and so on. And there's also photonic systems now. As different as these systems are, they are, I would say, common goals. And these common goals depend a bit on who you ask, but I think there are some people... Oh, this is wrong, actually. There's a common protocol, let's start with that. Basically, what we need to do is first to initialize a certain quantum state in these systems. So this initialization can be done with respect to a thermal equilibrium state, or you want some pure product state, say you want a spin system with all spins up and some spin down. We want to study some interesting evolution. This could be time evolution under a certain Hamiltonian, or if you wanted to open system dynamics under a certain Liouvillean. Quantum computing, this could be a sequence of gates in optical lattices. This could be an adiabatic change of the Hamiltonian or quench or something like this. And eventually, you want to detect something. So I need to measure some useful quantity. So this could be a correlation function, static or dynamic. It could be entanglement now with new schemes. Or if you're in a quantum computing lab, you maybe want to do state reconstruction. But there's also a common set of goals, I'd say. And these goals are for some to build quantum computers and networks. For some is to study many-body physics, so people call it quantum simulation. And for some is to generate useful states or useful systems for completely different tasks, say precision measurement. Okay. And now, this is all good, but experimentally, we are on the way towards these goals, but there's a few challenges that I want to list. And I want to also argue that we actually made some progress towards these challenges. So in particular, there's a scalability question. So we want to reach large and homogeneous systems. And this comes in differently in the different approaches. Say, if you're on a solid state, often it's difficult, for example, to make qubits that have the same transition frequency. So you get some inhomogeneous broadening. In ion traps, it has been difficult to scale up above 15 spins or 20 spins. Maybe now there's 30 spins. In optical lattices, we can make large systems, but we have basically this harmonic trapping on top of it. So this is challenging basically all of the systems, I think. There's a controllability question. So we want to have large systems, but we still want to be in control of them. So ideally, we want control over single particles or spins, and ideally also want control over interaction terms individually between pairwise atoms. Okay. At the same time, what I want to do is something interesting. So I want an interesting Hamiltonian, not just something boring. Okay. This has to come with low dissipation and defacing rates. We need to be able to initialize low entropy states with high fidelity. This has been a challenge, for example, in optical lattices in terms of reaching spin physics in Harvard models. Something that's often not cited but is actually a big challenge in cold gases experiments is fast experimental repetition rates. So these experiments typically take 30 seconds to repeat. So this is really a pain in the lab. And last but not least, we need to keep control of experimental complexity, which also has been a big challenge in cold gases labs in particular. Okay. Now I would like to briefly go through two approaches, basically with neutral atoms, and I'm only going to include basically the two main approaches that have a chance or have some idea of single atom control built into them. Okay, so the first one is basically optical lattices in a kind of traditional setups. So the preparation steps are the following. So start with atoms trapped in so-called magneto-optical trap. This is an ingenious invention that basically cools and traps atoms at the same time. You transfer to some sort of a non-dissipative trap, do evaporative cooling. You would reach a BC or a free Fermi gas or something like this. And then you would ramp up an optical lattice and maybe reach a mod insulating state. If you're in this mod insulating state or close to it, you can look at it with microscope now since a few years. This is a picture from the Greiner group. And so you basically can see individual atoms. So I call this top-down, basically because you're first making a gas and then you look at it with this microscope and try to control individual atoms in there. So this approach has some pros. So you can go to large numbers of atoms. You can go to relatively low entropy, but still limited in the spin sector. And but it's also a challenging approach because it's very complex experimentally. So this is an optical table from Emanuel's group. That's basically my PhD in one picture. And so you see there's a lot of elements. And this is actually increasingly a problem because the more you want to do with the systems, you add to that. And another challenge is really as long experimental cycle time. So you really have to wait basically half a minute in order to get a picture like this. Okay. So now there has been I'm going to skip over the details here. There has been a different approach, which is based on optical tweezers. So this has been done in a few groups. In the Riegel is one. There's a Paris group, Antoine Pravez, and so on. So the idea is a bit different. You stick a very tightly focused dipole trap, tweezer, into this magneto-optical trap, and you wait until you trap a single atom. Okay. And the idea is that you basically want to have control over each of these tweezers. So it's a bit different. So I'm not making a BC or so at all. Okay. So this is nice. Has very short cycle times. Order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude faster. It's much simpler setups. And you have basically a kind of intrinsic built-in control of each trap and therefore also about each, like for each atom. So the challenge, however, is the following. So if you make a few of these tweezers, so this is a picture from Paris. So they make a lattice of these tweezers, basically. And then you load the atoms from the mod. What you will see is you have some stochastic loading. So you take a picture and you see about 50% of these traps are only filled. So you would repeat it and you would see different traps are filled. Okay, so this is a problem for scaling up into kind of defect-free systems. And if you look at it, okay, you could say, okay, I'm just going to wait until all of them are filled, you know, if I'm patient. But it scales exponentially bad. So if you have a 50% filling factor, the probability to have n traps filled is p, which is 50% to the power of n. So it's really bad for you. So you can count how long you have to wait experimentally. Even if you have a fast cycle time, we'll see even for 10 traps to be fully filled, you have to wait 100 seconds already. And it gets worse and worse. So this is it's not a good tactic, basically. What we have been working on is basically based on this tweezer approach, but now with really many tweezers. And we're using a measurement and feedback scheme to remove this entropy which comes from this loading of the traps, basically. Okay, and here's the scheme, basically, in a nutshell. I'll give a bit more details in a second. So we basically make an array of these tweezers, stick them into a magneto-optical trap. Okay, I'll show you later. We can make up to 100 and maybe in the future thousands of these guys. Now, the idea is the following. I can basically take an image of this thing and see which of the traps is full, which of the traps is empty. And just say, okay, let's switch off the empty ones. And then if I want to go back to a regular array, I can just rearrange everything such that it's regular, like this. That's simple in these pictures. And second?
How do optical tweezers work?
Okay. It's based on basically AC star shifts of atoms. So you have a two-level system. Any of these optical traps are basically based on AC star shift, just like optical lattices. So you have a two-level system. You shine in a laser with some frequency, and if it's far detuned, you will see that the interaction, that the potential you get is basically you're not scattering on this state anymore, but you're basically adiabatically trapping this guy down here, and you will see that this depends on the intensity of the laser. And now, if this laser intensity is spatially dependent, you get a spatially dependent wrapping potential. So in simple terms, if you have say, intensity profile, it looks like this. You will get a trapping potential, looks like this. This is all. And now these tweezers are basically very tightly focused laser beams. Okay, so you can basically take a lens, or in our cases, this is a high resolution objective, but you can also set a lens. You come in with a big laser beam, and this will be very tightly focused, basically. Looks like this. Okay, and then if you make a cut in this direction, for example, what you would see is exactly such a Gaussian intensity profile. And you can trap individual atoms in here. So the length scales are quite tight. So in our case, for example, this extension is only order of a micrometer. So it's really, really tightly focused. And the trick is really to have many of them and really control all of them individually. And it's kind of a technical challenge. I'll show you how we do this in a second. So say we have this defect-free arrays, then the idea is to really try to engineer interactions afterwards. I'll come back to this question later. How do we do this experimentally? So we come in with a single laser beam, and we want to make a lot of them out of this. So what we use is called an acousto-optical deflector. It's basically a little crystal and has a sound wave that travels in it, and the sound wave basically deflects the beam. It's kind of it acts like a diffraction grating in some sense with a traveling wave. And now if you basically plug in an RF frequency into this acousto-optical deflector, you create a single sound wave, and if you do it right, you get a single deflected beam that comes out at an angle. Okay. Now, if you come in with a different frequency for this RF wave, you come out at a different angle. And there's some range in which you can do that. Okay. Now, if you come in with many frequencies, basically with a kind of frequency comb in this RF frequencies, you basically get many beams out. Okay. So here's just sketched with three beams. So this is the idea. We apply many frequencies to this acousto-optical deflector. Now, we do this with some fast digital waveform synthesizer that I'm not going to talk about. But basically, most of the experimental challenge lies in this waveform generation, actually. And anyway, so we use a bit of optics and then basically image these beams into a vacuum chamber here with a high-resolution objective. We don't understand everything. In essence, it's set up such that this three beams, for example, here will create three of these tightly focused tweezers now in the vacuum chamber. Okay. We start by loading a magneto-optical trap that's overlapped with these tweezers. And now we switch off the magneto-optical trap, and then we check what do we have in the tweezers. Okay. And after we check what we have in the tweezers, we can basically do this feedback, look at it, switch it off, and move the tweezers around. And now the challenge is really to create these RF waveforms with this many tweezers on the fly, because I don't know what I'm going to get, because this is stochastic. Okay, so this is how it looks like in practice. It's a bit simpler than standard cold gases apparatuses. Here's a zoom into the vacuum chamber. Here you see this glass cell, and this is high resolution objective and two coils and so on. Let me show a few experimental results of this feedback procedure. Just to be clear, this is, again, the scheme in maybe a different representation. So here, time axis position, you have all these tweezers. We do a first measurement. Afterwards, we switch off the empty ones. And then we sweep the frequencies of this AOD, basically. So we have each of these beams is basically generated by one RF frequency. And I need to have to control over them. I switch some of them off and move them around. So it's a very complicated waveform in this RF thing. And then we take a final picture afterwards to verify if we actually reached our goal to get this defect-free arrays. So just to have a look at the tweezers itself. So in our apparatus, we only 1D so far, but we can make up to 100 of these tweezers now. So there's 100 RF frequencies, makes 100 beams, get 100 tweezers. And this is a picture just of the tweezer potential itself. Now, if you stick them into a mod, you will see pictures like this. So you take the first picture, it's randomly loaded. So you see there's an empty tweezer, two empty tweezers, and so on and so on. We take this picture, analyze it with a computer, generate the right waveforms, and then move it into this defect-free array. Okay. So what I'm showing you now is a video of repeating this whole procedure. You first see this randomly loaded arrays and then defect-free arrays. If it's working. Okay. So you basically see this, and then this is the end product. Okay. Works quite well. on a qualitative level at least. Okay. I'll show you another video now of the actual movement itself. It's actually quite instructive, I think. So what you see here is for a smaller number of traps, we once did this actually complicated to take this video, so that's why we did it in a smaller trap. So you see the initial loading, and then we move everything to the right and get the factory, basically. Okay.
Are you actually heating these things up when you move it?
No. We heat them up just by keeping them by itself. So we know we have some heating mechanisms. What we do in here is actually we have sub-Doppler cooling on during the whole procedure. We just don't look at it.
But the single tweezer has what kind of a trap frequency? What's
the 100 kilohertz. And we move basically adiabatic.
And are you doing sideband cooling on this?
Not yet.
In the ground state or not?
Not yet. I'll come back to this. So this is say sub-Doppler temperatures. We are at, you know, maybe 30 microkelvin, but not fully in the ground state.
But here you would never be able to get, I mean, this is sort of like doing a mod insulator by hand, but without tunneling.
Yeah.
But would you be able to melt this thing and get the superfluid out and come so close together that...
Come back to this question. Patient. Comes at the end.
Well, how close together are they? I mean,
so here we work with lattice spacing of 2.5 micrometers. This is, okay. In principle, you can get them as close as you want until they merge. So the question is when you lose that, I mean, I can show you later. So you basically, if you look at these trapping potentials, if they're fully separated, they're fully modulated, basically. But you can bring them closer together such that they overlap, and then you will see something that looks like this. So this distance can go to zero, but I think the question is a little bit when you lose the last bound state and so on. And this depends a lot on the parameters. So in principle, you can merge them, and I'll show you some stuff later from Cindy Riegel's group. They did that. So this actually talking about Peter's, I'm not sure if you see it, but Peter's question. So you can ground state cool it and bring them together and then see tunneling between the tweezers in principle, okay, if you want that. But there's other ways of, you know, making them talk to each other. I'll come back to this. That is actually... for example, using Rydberg atoms, this 2 micrometer scales that we have, 3 micrometers actually perfect. So in principle, this works. You can bring them close together. There's a complexity in this waveforms because you did this diffraction with the AOD. All of these tweezers actually, the light has a slightly different frequency. So that's actually, and they are all phase locked, which is with respect to each other the way we do it. So this E field of this guy has a different frequency from the E field of that guy. And you basically get a time-dependent interference term. And the limit is actually not optically in our case, or it's a combination of optical and this time-dependent interference term. If you bring them close together, you start interfering, and at some point you heat. And okay, so without going into details, if you do the math, if you want to bring them closer together, you will see you can only do it with fewer tweezers. So maybe if you go to 50 tweezers, you can merge them. With 100, I think it doesn't work.
Do you turn on an optical lattice afterwards and just, you know, as a way to load an optical lattice?
Not yet, but you could do that. I'm also coming back to this now.
Sorry, do you have harmonic trap here?
Say again.
Harmonic trap. Do you have?
How many?
Harmonic trap.
The harmonic trap. No. This is important. So this is really different from optical lattice experiments. These are all individual tweezers, and I can control the depth as at will. I'm not going to show you, but we have some data, and we can see this is very homogeneous, actually. It's as homogeneous as we can measure. So.
But the harmonic background trap in an optical lattice is more an experimental artifact than it is fundamental.
It's fundamental, I think.
No, it is not fundamental. If I take a Bluetooth-tuned light, for example,
I trap the nodes. This is true, Peter, but I think you cannot... The imaging is tricky. So if you want to make a microscope, it's kind of fundamental. You cannot go arbitrarily large.
Optical lattice is much closer, so in this sense. Well, an optical lattice has a distance which is actually lambda over 2, so it's a completely different scale. But I don't think that the harmonic oscillator is fundamental for an optical lattice.
Yeah, it is fundamental if you want.
Like a kind of a box trap.
Yeah, but this is not so easy, Peter. I understand.
No, it's not easy, but it's not fundamental.
Well, people have been talking about removing this for a decade now, right? So, and they haven't done it, I think, on a lattice. So I think it works to some degree, and I agree you can make box potentials, but I think one of the problems is if you want to image with a quantum microscope in the end, you need extremely deep lattices. And these extremely deep lattices, you at the moment, with the atoms that I use, for example, with rubidium or cesium or whatever, people are using potassium now, you have to focus this lattices that you need for the imaging to very kind of like 50 micrometers.
Okay, but what you is that at the end it's a question of having enough laser power at the end is cheap. Right?
No, it's not cheap. Okay. This is fully at the limit.
It's theory perspective.
There's no, I mean, this is 50 watts, that's the limit since 10 years, so I'm not sure if anyone's going to invent a new laser, but just saying. I think it's true, so to answer the question, I think you can make larger homogeneous systems, but it's hard to image all of it. So I think the way to do this is basically experimentally make a large system and then maybe just image a subsection of it. I think this is the answer. I agree what you're saying. This is really coming from a different direction. I'll argue a little bit what the pros and cons are at the end. Okay? Any more questions? We have a lot of time. I can skip slides. All right. So these are this before and after. So a few quantitative results. So if I start with the first image, I can look at what's the probability of a single atom as a function of trap index, and I go with 60% approximately in our case. Now, after this rearrangement, I see everything's to the left. I'm very close to 1. And I basically have this cutoff at 60, which comes from the fact that I have 60% of 100 traps, kind of obvious. And there's a certain width, which is this initial probability distribution width, basically. Now, more interestingly than that is the question is, what's the probability of actually finding a defect-free array? So in the end, say I want to do spin physics in the thing. So I don't want to have a hole. Okay. And before rearrangement, this goes down very quickly. So the reason is very simple again. So you have 60% probability for a single atom to have all of them trapped. This goes exponentially bad for you. So this is this very fast decay. After rearrangement, looks like this. So we see this initial slope goes down. I'll explain the shape in a second, but to remember, basically, we can make around arrays of around 50 atoms with 50% probability. Okay, so 50% of the shot, we're going to have, say, 50 atoms. So the logic for this curve is the following. So you see, for example, this dashed line. This dashed line is basically this curve, but P1 replaced with the probability that you have a single atom on that trap, and just goes on. So we see, basically, this dashed line experimentally, for example, is only given by the losses due to background collisions. So there's not an infinite lifetime in these traps, and that's a big limit. So you have collisions with background gas, and this basically gives you an exponential decay of single atoms in these traps. And while you're doing this rearrangement, you're basically colliding with the background atoms. So you cannot take infinite time for this. And we see basically that for small array sizes, we are limited basically by background collisions, and then this solid curve is basically what you could get if you had no losses, just given how many atoms you have initially. So you cannot make more than 60 atoms because that's what you have. And this dashed dotted is basically just the product of both, which represents this very well. So we're mostly limited by these two things. We have a few additional losses during the movement. Okay. Now, you can look at the time it takes you to make a certain array. Say I want to be 100% sure I have a 50-atom array. I have the 50% chance to do it. I just do it twice on average, and then I'm going to have it. So I basically can certify if I have a hole or not first, okay? And then I can look at the average time to make an array like this. This is essentially the basic repetition rate I have. So this is, say, 200 milliseconds, and then divided by this probability, okay? And I can just plot this. It's just a way of replotting these things. But it's interesting experimentally to look at this. So what you see is, for example, with this, without rearrangement, this is basically the curve I showed you before. You have to wait forever until you get a reasonable size array. Now, with this rearrangement, we can see, for example, at 50 atoms, if I want to do that, with our repetition rate, we can do this in 0.4 seconds. So it's up to 60 atoms is below a second or so. And this is experimentally, it's really working in this lab is a different regime now for us, because you can look at the stuff and optimize at the stuff. You don't have to wait half a minute all the time for things to happen. So this is a huge advantage, actually. You can do a few more tricks. So this geometry, in the end, is in principle, we can do arbitrary stuff in 1D up to some sort of minimal lattice space. So we can start with something random, and then we can make clusters of 2, clusters of 10. We can vary the repetition in each shot and do whatever you want. So I think this is nice also for spin systems. For example, you could have clusters of 2, and then they interact strongly, and these clusters interact with each other and things like that. A few more tricks we can play, just to give you an idea. For example, you could say, if you want to make a 40-atom array, why, and you have 60, why don't you keep 20 on the side check if you have 50, if you have your 40. If you have a hole, you fill in one. Okay, this is this kind of reservoir scheme that we have. So you can divide the system in system and reservoir, and then you can do tricks like this. Basically, you see 20 atom arrays as an example, and I want to keep this 20 atom array. I'm going to check I have a hole, then I'm going to refill it from the left, like this. And here's a real-time video of this 20 atom array case, for example. So we want to keep 20 here, and whenever we lose an atom, we refill it from the left, from the right. So this reservoir basically depletes, and we're kind of refilling this guys. This looks a bit like just playing around, but it actually has some value. For example, this initial filling probabilities, you can actually increase by that on a faster time scale than reloading the whole thing. All right. So this is almost everything I have about experimental results. I want to discuss a few things that are future work, in particular scaling to 2D. We want to talk about spin control, and then I come back maybe to Peter's question and a few other people's question. How can we actually engineer interactions? How we can make use of this thing? Now, scaling to 2D, can be done in two different ways. So the most naive way is to just take two of these acousto-optical deflectors and cross them. So what happens is one of them makes an array, and the other one makes copies of that array, basically. And now if you just do it in 90 degrees, you're going to get a square lattice. If you do it in a different angle, you can do a triangular lattice or anything that has a single, has a fundamental cell with just only one atom, basically. You can go in with two beams, and you can make hexagonal lattice. If you have three beams, you could do Kagome. So there's all kinds of things you can do with this. Another one is to basically, that goes a bit into this idea to put them in an optical lattice or something like this. You can have a static array, and they try to sort it into that static, right, into the static array. And this has been done, actually, by Antoine Provez. They also showed similar results that we did in 2D, but with significantly smaller system sizes. So it's working in 2D, but you have to work a little bit to scale it up. We did a few calculations based on the kind of time scales we have, and the like experimental vacuum limited lifetimes, and so on. And basically, what you see is the initial numbers of rows and columns, and it's kind of what we estimate how large of systems you can get. So in this first method, if you do it right, maybe you can get to, if you're really lucky, to 400. With the second method, I think this is a more feasible long term. You can get up to several hundreds. I'm not sure. So this is not completely trivial to do this to simulations, and it's not completely clear what you actually mean with this. I think this is already pessimistic. I think you can probably go to thousands if you do it right. Okay. Right. Just to be conservative, I think we can do hundreds of atoms in 2D within, you know, 2 years or so. That's my estimate. What we're currently working is basically single atom spin control. We can quickly go through this. So these atoms have hyperfine ground manifolds that you can use to encode spins, basically. There's some excited optical states. You can do the spin control via Raman transitions, or you can do the spin control via microwave. So we started a bit with microwave. For example, we showed that we can have very good global coherent oscillations. Now you can say, okay, I want to address one of these guys. There's a few tricks that you can play. For example, you can shift one of them, the transition frequency, using an optical addressing beam, and then apply microwave frequency. We did this back in Munich in optical lattices. The point I want to make is that in these arrays, I think this is going to be much, much easier. So this was really a challenge back then, and it's still a challenge. One point I want to make is that this actually is not fully developed in optical lattice. So there's no full spin control. It's not true. So we can only do pi pulses right now. There's no arbitrary Bloch sphere rotations on a single atom level. And this has to do with the small length scales, and also has to do with the fact that you're basically creating these lattices traditionally externally by interfering laser beams, and you have to aim really, really well with your objective, and everything moves with respect to each other. Here, this is all a bit intrinsic. You can go through these AODs, and you have the traps, and it will all be much easier. Okay, what I want to discuss a little bit now is how can we actually engineer interactions between these guys. Okay, so there's a multitude of options. Just write down three now and then go into detail for two of them. So what you can do is, in principle, you could try to let atoms tunnel, either between tweezers, or you bring them into an optical lattice, or contact to say. You could use dipole-dipole interactions. The most straightforward way would be to go to Rydberg states. But you could also think of something a bit more fancy. You could try to make little molecules in these guys. So you make two tweezers for different molecules, for different atoms, say potassium or cesium. You merge them together. you use the standard methods that people have via photo association, make a little molecule, and you do this with multiple tweezers, right? I think specifically for these kind of things where you look at dipole-dipole interaction or any kind of spin physics, I think this is a feasible approach to do this, because what people usually do is a bit coming from far away. So they make it. So what you want in the end is basically static spins that are somewhere and that interact with each other. So you want this kind of product state in real space. But it seems like, okay, I make a BC, which is the complete opposite. So I'm completely delocalized. And then trying to go there, and it's really complicated. So we're kind of in the right regime there. And I think this will actually be much easier in that system. A third option is basically to use photon-mediated interactions. You could place them on a photonic crystal. And I think you can even geometrically put these arrays into traditional cavities. And then, for example, have, say, 50 atoms in the cavity, and then tune atoms in and out of cavity resonances and so on. And I think this is also much easier, I believe, than traditional ways of doing this. Okay, let me discuss two of these in a little bit more detail, not too much. So one is Rydberg atoms. I think you probably have heard about it, so just to repeat. So if you have these rubidium atoms, for example, in this ground state, the electronic wave function is very small. But you can excite them to very high quantum numbers, and then this blows up. So for example, it's a 43S state, so it blows up to 250 nanometers. And then the key point is that these atoms get very easily polarized. And this leads to very strong induced dipole-dipole interactions. So basically, van der Waals interaction can be very strong. Okay. So here's a sketch of this. Say you have two atoms at a certain distance, r. Basically, if both of them would be in this Rydberg state, you would see this very strong van der Waals interaction. And then generically, if you write this up, say for a bunch of atoms, this leads to kind of like an Ising model. You see that this van der Waals interaction is basically encoded in a sigma c Ising term with the van der Waals coefficient, and then you have an r to the 6 induced dipole-dipole interaction. Okay. There's a transverse field too, which comes from the driving, and there's also a field in perpendicular direction. This is the generic Hamiltonian you have. So now in our case, it's actually nice. So in principle, you could have control at the single atom level over this omega. So this would be an omega of I. And you could have control over this term to some degree by positioning them into more complex patterns. Okay, it's not full control over the whole matrix, but there's some control. And I should quote Peter and also work by Thomas Pohl. There's ideas to make more complex, for example, spin 1 XYZ models, or the ideas from Thomas are to go to spin 1 half, and Thomas has an idea for us going to spin 1. So there's playing with more basically levels.
I wanted to ask you, so you mentioned before that you got an oscillation frequency of about 100 kilohertz.
Yeah.
So the way that you draw it, that you really populate the Rydberg states, there will be significant forces on these atoms from these interactions.
Yeah.
Will you be able to go down to tweezers that are sort of, you know, so deep that these forces, and therefore there's this back action on the motion at the end, this is some sort of decoherence in these spin models?
Yeah.
Can be eliminated?
I don't know the answer, but I think you can make progress towards this. So first of all, I'm not sure if this is going to work with rubidium fully. So because one of the key challenges with these Rydberg atoms is actually they are not trapped at all. Right? So this is, if you go to the Rydberg atoms, undetrapped. So what people usually do, they work in a kind of like a Floquet almost way. So they switch on and off the traps. Whenever they have the Rydberg on, they switch off the trap. They have a, like, you know, I think it's a little bit of a mess. So I'll come back to this point. I think the only really feasible solution to fully go around this is to go to two electron atoms. So in two electron atoms, I'll show this later, you can have one of the electrons excited. And if you do it right, you can use the ionic core, which still has an electron, to really have a dipole trap there. And then the Rydberg states are fully trapped. So now you have to run the numbers if you're able to really overcome the forces such that this van der Waals potential has no significant, you know, heating or shift on these guys. I don't know. So the problem is, I think also if you go to Rydberg and it is trapped, you have this trapping frequency, so you're going to be so wide also in so this omega is going to be so big. And if it's not 100% magic, you're going to address multiple of these levels. I'm not sure if you can eliminate the heating in motion completely, but I think you can make progress. We'll have to see how far this goes. But with rubidium, it's tricky, I think. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions about Rydberg? Okay. So I'll quickly talk about tunneling. So this is a picture from Cindy Regan's group. So as mentioned, they basically did an experiment of this type, just with two tweezers. So they took one or two atoms in these tweezers, and then basically brought these tweezers closer together until you basically have a significant overlap of the ground state wave function. You get some tunneling. Okay. And as Peter mentioned, this is a key requirement. You have to be ground state cooled. Otherwise, this is a mess because you're just thermally populated. Okay, so this is something you have to do first. You can do this with, like this in rubidium case, with Raman ground state cooling. With a certain fidelity, I'll come back to this, and then you can do that. So the question is, and this is also what I had in mind, is can we assemble a mod insulator and melt it into a superfluid state? Okay, so the idea is that these arrays are basically, if you just strictly look at it, they are the many-body ground state of, say, a Hubbard model in a deep U limit, deep mod insulating limit. So I can assemble that thing, and if I have 100% ground state cooling, I could just bring these tweezers closer together and melt it. Okay. It might be a little bit tricky to do this directly in the tweezers, but let's sketch it maybe in a different way. So I could start with these tweezers, then overlap an optical lattice, switch off the tweezers, and then I would ramp down the lattices in this guy, would go into a superfluid. Okay.
So are you saying that you can bring the tweezers together to lambda over 2?
It depends on what lambda is. You know? So for example, I'll show you. I'll use.
So I give you a standard optical lattice. You're saying that you can bring
this. This is the question. I think you can do something between 500 nanometers and a micrometer. If it's a micrometer or 500.
Micrometer, these things don't tunnel anymore. Or you wait forever.
You have to wait a little bit longer, but I think I can go maybe to 700. I'm sure. So it depends on lambda, and I think this is a key actually. Okay. Well, these guys, you see, I mean, 600, but they did already. And I should say, these Swiss experiments are not at the kind of experimental level what like Marcos did or what we did in Munich. So these guys are using relatively low NA actually, so you can go higher.
The only thing is it goes exponentially with the distance.
I know.
It's bundled through this barrier, which becomes really, you know, big.
I know, but you can also have the barrier low, for example. So okay. So there are challenges. I named them here, and you're right. So the first challenge is actually, I think, the quality of the sideband cooling. So people have shown 95%. The question is, you can go much higher, and what it does if you're not in the ground state. I think you can go much higher if you go to tighter tweezers, and maybe you add some axial confinement. I think you can go high. God knows, we'll see. Length scales are tight, as Peter mentioned, so it's not completely easy to bring these guys closer together. So ideally, you want a bit more optical resolution, and you want to be able to make these tweezers basically smaller. Okay. And there's another challenge. If you look at the numbers, you want to have strong enough on-site interactions. So if you still, for example, what Cindy did is to just stay in tweezers is tricky, because these tweezers can be tight in a kind of radial direction, but actually they're not so tight. So these on-site wave functions are larger than an optical lattice, and it means your on-site interactions are smaller. And you want to drive this transition at relatively high energy scale. So U has to be reasonably large, and J has to be reasonably large. So that's a challenge there. So to wrap this up, so I'm not sure if this is going to work, so maybe. So, but you can say, okay, it's a very interesting conceptual experiment. The question is, did you gain anything in the end? So I'm not sure that you can do that, but so will it be better than optical lattice? Will it be faster? That's for sure, but if you can do different experiments, we'll have to see. Okay, so I want to do a quick discussion now. What did we gain, actually? So in terms of these common goals, I mainly talked a bit about many-body physics, but I think there's some value in these systems also for quantum computing. You could try to look into Rydberg gates on a bit different scale. For example, now with these pairwise things, you can optimize these gates much better. So there has been a pain for years now to really do better Rydberg gates, and I think you have a better chance now in this system. There's also this coupling to photonic degrees of freedom can be very powerful. For example, with this nanophotonic structures, you could have on-chip structures, multiple cavities with multiple atoms, each cavity one atom that could talk to each other, send photons from one cavity to each other. So like Misha dreams about these kind of things, you know. For me, it's not the main focus, but I think this really opens up new ways there. So for many-body physics, we'll have to see a little bit. I think definitely for Rydberg, this is a better platform even than optical lattices, because the length scales are also better. So and I think you have much better repetition rates, a single atom control, has everything you need. If you can do molecules, we'll see. This is a question. You can also do many body physics in cavities, I think, traditional cavities. We'll have to see how it works geometrically, but I think this is something that should work relatively straightforward. And then there's a few more ideas I can talk to you in private I have for Caltech that I don't want to put on the slides. In terms of precision measurement, I think you can also do things. For example, you could run an optical clock in these tweezers. Not sure if this is better than an optical lattice clock. I think it's more robust for sure. But you could, for example, use this Rydberg interactions to generate highly entangled state, say a GHC state, that helps you for doing precision measurements. Another option that I have been thinking a bit and also talking to people like Keith Schwab at Caltech is you could use these guys at single atom kind of scanning heads. So you could try to build an SDM or something like this with a single atom, move them on top of a surface. It's very challenging, but maybe there's a few tricks you can play. And you could do this with many at the same time. So you could look at correlation functions of magnetic fields or things like this. So you could use it as probes for solid state. It has been shown, for example, in this photonic crystal structures that you can get them close to surfaces up to, few hundred nanometers, which is actually a record for cold atoms. So in terms of challenges, so how do we stand? Scalability. So we have 50 atoms, so it's larger than ion traps, but much smaller than cold atoms. I think you can go up to a few hundred. And I think you can, if you do it right, you can make it very homogeneous. So this is nice. Controllability, I think it's a big step forward there. So I think this is much easier to control than optical lattice experiments. That's for sure. Maybe not as well developed yet as ion traps, but I think there's no fundamental reason not to have like full single atom control, everything coherent if you do it right. Engineering of interesting Hamiltonians, we'll see. So Rydberg, I think you can go further than you were able to do with optical lattices. In particular, for everything that's spin-spin, I think this is a good method. Also for molecules and so on. So we'll see how we go there. And also then if you have systems that couple to photonic degrees of freedom. Low dissipation defacing rate, I think these are almost the same as an optical lattice. It's maybe a little bit worse now. We'll have to work on this a bit. High fidelity initialization of low entropy states. What I showed you is that we're very good in getting rid of this on-site occupation number entropy, basically. So we actually have it certified. So there's 100% sure there's zero entropy there. What is more challenging is actually on-site occupation number, so harmonic trap levels. But the point is, for this Rydberg stuff, you don't need to be fully in a ground state. So you don't need to be a 99.999 there. So you can do the physics still, and it doesn't really cost you anything. For doing lattice physics, it's a different question. Spin states, if you want to do high fidelity initialization, you can just do optical pumping. It's going to be very good, same as in any other experiment. Fast experimental repetition rates, I think we made a huge step forward there. And this is actually something that maybe theorists don't appreciate. But if you have worked in Emanuel's lab for 5 years, and waited half a minute for every shot, you know what I'm talking about. Okay, so this is really, I think this is a completely different experiment in the lab. So you can look at stuff, optimize it, so we can really do stuff much faster also and can go to different regimes much faster. And experimental complexity, we also gain a lot. And the trick is really that we put a lot of complexity into kind of generating digital waveforms. We put it into electronics and we took it away from optics. So this normal experiments are optics massacre. But I think this is key now to be able to use things like AODs or spatial light modulators and these kind of things to get rid of some of the optics. Okay, so I want to quickly say something about what I'm building up at Caltech. So we'll have many ideas, but I wanted to start first is to actually use strontium and now put it into this optical tube. So strontium is a two-electron atom. And I think this can help you a lot with a lot of these challenges to really go further. So it has a more complex level structure. You don't need to understand everything. So there's a singlet ground state, and then there's basically one broad transition, and then there's two. So one narrow and then one ultra-narrow transition and a few excited states. So there's many things and many proposals that have been written about using strontium or ytterbium for all kinds of things in quantum information, quantum simulation. But now just for this kind of platform that I was talking about, there's few immediate things that you can see. So first of all, you can trap with 532 because of this broad transition that is very low in wavelength. So you can use 532 nanometers for the tweezer. You get a huge bump in optical resolution, actually. So usually we use 809, so you get a factor of 809 divided by 532 improvement. So this is as if I go for rubidium from a 0.5 NA objective to a 0.8 NA objective, which is experimentally a complete mess. You cannot do that, actually. So this is if you're not Marcus, maybe. But so this is actually extremely convenient. The other thing is that with this 532, even you like related wavelengths close by, you can get a lot of power. So this is the question of, you know, spending money, but it's actually not so easy for the standard tweezer wavelengths that people are using to get a lot of power. So it's actually hard to make a lot of tweezers. So it's not completely scalable there. You could, of course, go to 1064, where there's a lot of power, but then you're losing optical resolution. So here you have both. You have optical resolution, and I think you can, power-wise, you can make 5,000, maybe 10,000 tweezers, if necessary. So this is a huge advantage. You can also look at this 461 photons, and you basically can resolve this whole thing. So now I can go back to Peter's question. Is if I use this 532 with a reasonable objective, I think I can bring them, you know, even fully resolved to 700 nanometers or something like that. So I think it's length scale-wise, you can do it. It's a bit tough, but it's possible. So these narrow transitions are helpful. So for example, you can do direct single photon sideband cooling now. This is pretty straightforward, I think. You also have this clock transition. You have a basically optically addressable spin here. Rydberg properties are different. So as I mentioned, these Rydberg states are now trappable. So the idea is basically you have two electrons. You shoot one of them into a Rydberg state. You have one electron left. And that thing you have left basically looks like an alkali atom, a bit more tightly bound because you have one proton too much. But you can use this alkali atom and trap it as a normal alkali atom. And via this is really a kind of unique possibility to now actually trap these Rydberg states and then also have these Rydberg atoms under more control, I think, experimentally. In strontium, there's another thing that's interesting is that the Rydberg states, they have both repulsive and attractive branches. So this helps you in terms of these models, and you can also reach new physics, I think. So there's an idea, for example, from Thomas Pohl of basically a one-step GHC state preparation, which is extremely complicated, actually, with alkali. But with this strontium atoms, I think it might be feasible and much easier. And also, bosons have no hyperfine structure, and I think this will also be a huge advantage for Rydberg because I think many of the problems that people have comes from that this Rydberg state have hyperfine structure. And people are not spectrally resolving this hyperfine structure. So it's only resolved by a polarization, by a rules, basically, transition rules. So and if your polarization is a little bit off, your magnetic field is a little bit off, you're talking to multiple Rydberg states. It's not the physics that you write down. And I think the suspicion that people have why these Rydberg gates are not working so well is actually because of this coupling to multiple states. So now, if I use a boson here, there's no hyperfine structure. There's only one state, and that I can spectrally solve. So it will be a very clean system. And in addition, I can actually do two photon transitions now via a narrow intermediate line. So basically, the photon scattering also from this intermediate line, it goes basically just with the line width of this intermediate line at a given Rabi frequency. So I'm basically one order of magnitude better than in rubidium. That's the hope, at least. Okay. And then, also ultimately, if you want to go to optical lattices, there's a range of magic wavelengths that helps you with state-dependent trapping with less heating. So as people have been talking about this for many years now, but I think it would be good to use these properties and then combine it with a microscope. I'm not sure if you want to go to optical lattices, if this is the best approach, we'll see. So the idea is a bit to throw these strontium atoms into tweezers to learn how to image them, learn how to control them, and then we'll see if you want to build a traditional experiment or use this kind of tweezer techniques for optical lattice physics. For Rydberg, I still think this tweezer is much better. Okay. Here's a summary. I showed you how to make large arrays in optical tweezers generated by this AOD. I showed you feedback on track position that overcomes this probabilistic filling. I talked a bit about ongoing and future work, single qubit rotations in actions via Rydberg excitations. So here's the archive. It will actually come out next week in Science. November 3 is the online publication date. Okay, so this is the team from Harvard. So this was done with Misha and also Vladan and Markus discussed a lot with us. But the people who really did the work were these three guys. So basically, this is Hannes Bernien, is a postdoc who came from Delft, and then two grad students. This is Harry and this is Alexander. And these guys did the core work in the lab together with me. Okay, with this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Can you make or with your tweezers, molecules which have rotational symmetry?
Rotational symmetry?
Like water.
Yeah, people are actually starting to think about this. Yeah. So that, you could try to assemble something like this. The problem is to, I think you can trap them in tweezers. You need to trap O and H, right? The problem is the laser cooling of these guys. I think there's a lot of actually progress now. So in UCLA, they have new methods actually to do magneto optical. You need to do basically these magneto optical traps with weird wavelengths, that is kind of UV wavelengths that are hard to reach. But they have some stuff now they can do with pulse lasers, and it works. I think it works with rubidium now, and I think you can do it with these things. So actually, I think John Doyle is starting to think about this now. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert.
Why you want to do that? I mean, you want the PC of water, or what's the?
Well, no. I mean, it's interesting coupling the, there's basically, if you have identical, like in water, you have para and ortho states, where the nuclear spin states of the protons are coupled to the, the allowed angular momentum states. And I mean, I'm particularly interested in how the nuclear spin state couples to the chemical reaction rates.
Should have a talk about this actually.
You should do that. Nice talk at Caltech recently. Interesting. So, yeah, I think maybe this is a good point. I want to make a statement about this. So I think what this technique is also good for, and I haven't talked about this, is to work with atoms that you cannot work otherwise. So some of the atoms are just not good to make them a BC because of collisional properties. You cannot cool them. There's magnesium and all these kind of things. And I think with these guys, in principle, you can put them in these tweezers and still work with them. So there's we don't care about the collisions to start with. So maybe this opens up different avenues now. So this is kind of a very broad statement, but I believe that is just generically true.
So what limits speed of how fast you can drive? Is there some hardware limitations?
It's on-site trapping frequencies. If you just go too fast, you're non-adiabatic.
But that's interesting regime in principle, right? So how strongly non-adiabatic can you go, from hardware point of view, in a sense that,
Hardware itself can be very fast. I think this is the digital thing. This is very fast if you know what you want to do in advance. So the problem here is the feedback. So you can think about these RF waveforms, but they're more different waveforms than I can store on a computer. So I have to generate them on the fly, and we really generate them digitally point per point, and then there's a digital analog conversion. This is very complicated. If you know what you want to do, it's going to be arbitrarily fast. The limit in the end is this acousto-optical deflector, and then it depends on what kind of model you're using, because there's a finite time these sound waves take to travel through your beam, basically. And this is the limit. In the end.
But that is fast. So again, principle.
This is fast compared to any atomic timescales, I think.
If you're interested in studying some strong non-adiabaticity regime, maybe with interactions or with
You could do that. I think you could do that. Depends a bit on with respect to which interactions. I think this Rydberg can be gigahertz is strong. I think this would be tricky, but with respect to trapping frequencies.
Still have one question about your last slide, where you said that you want to trap the core and then sort of the Rydberg would be trapped out there. So I know that there have been some estimates in the literature about what the corresponding lifetime of the trap would be, because if I have the core and then excite an electron, even though it's off resonant, in principle these things can actually auto ionize.
Yeah.
So how optimistic are you about lifetimes?
I don't have the numbers in my head. I read the paper by Thomas. He did that, and he said it's like. The bottom line of his calculations was that this is not the limit in the end. The limit is again still spontaneous decay and things like that. We have to try. I'm not sure. I don't think anyone has tried that. I mean, there's anyway with two electron atoms. There's maybe two experiments in the world or three. I don't know. And the only one who really does this reasonably well is Tom Killian. And everything was done in bulk, so you don't know your collisions and so on. I think one has to try that and see. I mean, I think it's significantly away from threshold. I think this suppresses a bit, but honestly, we'll have to see. We're also not at magic wavelengths, so there's ideally you would go to a magic wavelength, where the Rydberg is the same as the ground state. So this 532 is not magic, so it's about half of the ground state. Actually, these magic wavelengths are bad for other reasons, because they are very close to the ionic transition frequencies. You get a lot of scattering again. So it's not so good to do that, actually. I have to see.